We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show. We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Meditation Studio. I'm Patricia Karpus. Today, we have a special sleep edition of Untangle for those of you, like me, who wake up in the middle of the night and have trouble falling back to sleep. This one's for you. And this edition is sponsored by our amazing sleep partner, mattress company Sattva. Their mattresses are this perfect mix of luxury, affordability, and they're made with eco-friendly materials. Even better, you can order them online and there's a 120-night home trial. For more information, check out their website at Sattva, S-A-A-T-V-A mattress.com. Our guest today is Dr. Shelby Harris. She's a psychologist and a sleep medicine expert, so I was thrilled to hear her advice on how we get to sleep and how we stay asleep. She gives us so many great tips and tools for eliminating insomnia. I love this episode. And when you're done, check out our sleep meditation collection on Meditation Studio, our 5-star app in the App Store, or on Google Play. Shelby is our flagship expert for sleep, so you'll hear her meditations there. And we have some sleep meditations on Alexa, so just say, Alexa, enable Meditation Studio, and you'll have access to those too. Now, here's Shelby. Shelby, it's great to have you on Untangle today. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's great to have an expert to talk to us about insomnia, because I know so many people have this problem, including me. So
yeah.
Will you start by explaining what insomnia is and kind of give us some ideas of how people can know if they have insomnia versus, you know, just kind of our restless sleepers?
So the definition for insomnia really is trouble falling asleep, trouble staying asleep, or trouble awakening too early. So if you have any of those problems where you really are struggling with falling asleep, waking in the middle of the night, or waking too early, then it is possibly insomnia. But the other part of the definition is that it has to create a problem for you. So if you're bothered by just being awake in the middle of the night, you're annoyed by it, or you're tired during the day, or you find that you're really having memory problems or attention problems, then you definitely qualify for insomnia.
Let's say you wake up in the middle of the night and you read a book for an hour and then you go back to bed and you're not too annoyed by it. That wouldn't count as insomnia because it's not a problem for you.
you know, it's a fine line, right? So some people just don't complain about it. And if you don't complain about it, then you never really actually get diagnosed with insomnia. People start going to the doctor when they're annoyed by it, and that's when they start getting treatment for it, and then they get labeled insomnia. You know, it's not normal to be awake for an hour or two in the middle of the night. It is normal to awaken a few times in the middle of the night. Everyone actually wakes up 5 to 7 times in the middle of the night between sleep cycles. Just most people don't remember it. They go right back to sleep right away. But it is normal to have 1 or 2 awakenings. You have to use the bathroom, whatever it is. You wake up. I do it. But if you're awake for a long amount of time in the middle of the night, that's a problem. Or if you wake up a lot throughout the night, or you have to use the bathroom a lot, then you really should get it looked at.
And different people need different amounts of sleep at night. So if somebody's sleeping 4 hours a night, maybe they don't have insomnia because they can still feel energetic during the day. Or what do you think about that?
You know, the sleep need is it's an interesting and controversial topic in some areas, in that the range is really around 6 to 9 hours. That's kind of where they get that number 8 from, that golden number 8, is just because it's sort of in the middle. But really, the majority of people, about 70% of the population, falls between 6 and 9 hours a night. So if you're in that range and you feel well rested and refreshed during the day, and you don't find that it's creating any problems, and remember, everyone has a dip during the day. It's normal to get tired after lunch or to have some dips here and there. But if generally you feel okay during the day, then you're getting enough sleep. That being said, there are some outliers. There are some people who just need less than 6 hours. There are some people who need more than 9 hours. Those people are more unusual, but the majority of people are between 6 and 9. But it is not that everyone needs exactly 8.
Right. And when you are experiencing insomnia, you either can't get to sleep or you're up a lot during the night. What is usually causing it, or what are some of the causes of insomnia?
There are so many causes for insomnia in the middle of the night. You know, it could be, it really does vary. So for some people, it could be, think about it as psychiatrically, it could be stress, could be depression, it could be anxiety. You go to sleep because you have something on your mind, and then you wake up with it on your mind. Now, I see that very commonly. I see a lot of people who have chronic pain issues, and they get in bed and then they wake up in the middle of the night because they shifted to some position, or their hip is starting to hurt, or their arm is starting to hurt. And then another very common thing that starts to happen is, as women start to get closer to perimenopause and then menopause, their hormones are starting to shift. And that can cause more awakenings and early morning awakenings just due to hormone changes, as well as hot flashes in the middle of the night. And a lot of women in that age range will just say that they wake up, they're having a hot flash, and that their minds are just racing and they can't stop thinking and they can't relax.
And what kinds of solutions do you offer for these problems?
Right. So when it comes to insomnia in general, you know, it's interesting. There used to be the idea in the field that we treat the quote unquote underlying cause, whatever that is. So if someone came to us with depression, or they came to us with chronic pain, we would always try and treat the quote unquote primary issue first, with the hopes that the insomnia would go away. What we've seen over the past 10 or 15 years is that that's actually not the case. You can treat the depression, you can treat the pain, whatever the issue is that's going on, but the insomnia usually stays there. It's the residual symptom that doesn't go away. So what we've started to do is treat it more as comorbid symptoms. So something on the side, not on the side, but a separate issue, as opposed to something that's a secondary symptom. So it really deserves its own treatment. So if you think that you're depressed and you have some insomnia, really try to get a separate treatment for the insomnia. So what are the treatments that are available? The two most popular treatments that we have are, they fall in two camps. One is medication treatments, and those are very popular, you know, medications that we hear about all the time that primary care doctors typically prescribe. And then there's the other camp that is cognitive behavior therapy for insomnia. And that is actually now recommended by major physician boards as being the gold standard treatment for insomnia. And what that is it's changing certain behaviors that people are engaging in that's actually maintaining the insomnia. So it could be changing your bedtime, changing your wake time. What people with insomnia typically do is they start to spend more time in bed. They go to bed earlier, or they sleep in the morning, or they try to nap in hopes that you'll catch the sleep when you can. That actually worsens it in the long run. So we come up with a very personalized, almost restricted sleep program. So your body starts to actually sleep only in that window and consolidated sleep. Other recommendations would be things like using the bed only for sleep and sex. It sounds kind of silly to a lot of people because they're used to watching TV in bed and reading in bed. But as you start to develop insomnia, you start to spend more time awake in bed, and your body actually starts to learn that the bed is only a place for laying awake and sometimes sleeping. So if we can teach your body to only sleep in bed and sometimes have sex, that's actually a very powerful conditioning tool that really is very effective for insomnia. Those two things I just mentioned are very hard to do for a lot of people, but if you work with someone or there are really good books and apps out there that can help people, if you're really motivated to do it and you're consistent with it, it can be very effective. And then there's things like sleep hygiene that we follow when it comes to insomnia. It's not always a full cure, but it can be things like limiting caffeine within, say, 8 hours of going to bed, depending upon the time that you go to bed at night, limiting exercise within 3 hours of going to bed, limiting liquids and heavy meals and alcohol within 3 hours of going to bed, making sure that you wind down an hour before bed. That's a really big one. I really see a lot of people using a lot of bright light exposure. They're getting a lot of blue light, TVs, phones right before going to bed, and their brains are basically thinking that the sunlight's out and it's making it harder for them to go to bed. We need to work more on stress management in our society. And I think that learning to wind your brain down before going to bed is really important to help set the stage for sleep. And there are a lot of techniques to help you do that. Mindfulness being one of them, relaxation exercises. But we really need to try and set the stage for sleep and then help your body and your brain relax to be able to go to sleep at night.
Will you talk a little bit specifically about how meditation helps you set the stage for a good night's sleep?
Right. So a lot of times when people start to develop insomnia, a lot of the patients that I work with will tell me almost that they never really thought about sleep before until they had insomnia. And now they start to dread the night as it gets closer. And so they're thinking a lot about, will I sleep tonight? What's going to happen tonight? If I don't sleep tonight, what's going to happen tomorrow? And there's this very active thought process that's going on that's very future oriented. It's not really in the moment. And in order to be able to go to sleep, you need to be present in the moment and just focusing on breathing, relaxing, quiet. Because if you're just listening to all the thoughts, the noisy thoughts that are happening in your brain, it tends to actually make you more tense. And it tends to make your heart go a little bit faster. It makes your muscles tense up a little bit more. And those are all things that actually make it harder for you to be able to go to sleep. So mindfulness, whatever mindful exercise it is that you find works for you, helps your brain to be able to focus on whatever relaxation exercise you're doing and to just focus on your deep breathing. Focus on just listening to the noise of the white noise machine that's right outside that you hear. And if your mind starts going to, will I sleep tonight? Will I be able to function tomorrow? Say, nope, not now. Back on track. Back on what I was doing. And it helps you to refocus to what you're doing in the moment to help set the stage for sleep.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. We talk about these often on Untangle. When we keep things bottled up inside, it can start to impact our health. Mentally, emotionally, and physically. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest, whatever it is. If this sounds like you, and it's a bit of all of us, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule and needs. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/untangle today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/untangle. Now over to Untangle.
A number of amazing meditations on Meditation Studio app. Yeah, and we love them, and all of our customers love them as well. How can people on their own sort of release body tension and let that go? Or do you always recommend using like guided meditations?
You know, I find if you have a lot of body tension, I find one of the best ways to release it is first to learn how to just do deep breathing. That's not necessarily going to relax your entire body, but a lot of the other meditations that are on there, I have one that's called progressive muscle relaxation and passive muscle relaxation. We talk about taking deep breaths, but if you don't know how to do a good deep breath at the beginning through your diaphragm and then relaxing, it's not going to make the other types of muscle relaxation exercises work as well. So I find if you can do deep breathing first and just practice that during the day or even at the night, that's fine. But the best ones, I think, for muscle tension are really the ones where you either passively envision your muscles melting. But I personally, for myself, really like the ones where you tense certain muscles and then you relax them. So you can start to feel the difference between what a tense muscle feels like that you've held on to for 10 to 15 seconds and then what a relaxed muscle feels like. And if you do that exercise for 10 to 15 minutes, a lot of my patients, when I do it with them in session, I can see their faces just melt as they're doing it and they really respond very well to it.
Oh, that's so great. You know, what we also hear a lot is that people have to learn to breathe properly. Like a lot of people don't do that deep belly breathing. They Yes. breathe through their chest. And that, in fact, like makes you feel a little bit more anxious.
You got it.
Yeah. How do you learn to breathe again as a young adult?
Yeah.
Or an old adult?
No, it's so interesting. You know, I always say to the patients, you know, I say, take a deep breath when they're sitting in the office. And they always just take a deep breath in. It's always through their chest. And, you know, that's fine. But you're sending a signal to your brain to get oxygen as fast as you can to your body for the fight or flight response. Like you're trying to breathe really fast and get oxygen so you can fight something or run away fast. And that's not a signal that you need to have in your brain before going to bed at night. So what I typically have patients do is I'll have them put one hand on their belly and one hand on their chest. And I try, if I have the space, to have them lay down on the couch or on the floor. And I'll have them take a deep breath and try almost to picture like someone has a string. This is how I learned how to do it myself a while ago. Someone has a string tied to a belly button and you're pulling the string up and you're pushing your belly full of air. And then you're letting go of the string and it's coming down. So you're trying to make sure that just your hand on your belly is moving and that your hand on your chest is only moving a tiny bit. It takes a lot of practice, but the more you can do it and really, it might feel like you're forcing air into your belly at the beginning, but after a while, it'll start to become second nature. But the best way to check it is to have one hand on your chest and one hand on your belly so you can see and lay down so you can see which hand is moving more.
Have you ever heard it called horizontal breathing versus vertical breathing?
Not so much. I mean, I've heard it mentioned that way. In the area of psychology that I practice, we usually just call it diaphragmatic breathing.
Right.
I think it's just everyone has their own term for it in a lot of ways.
Right. Yeah. Well, so that's so interesting that we all have these like challenges with how we breathe.
Yes.
Seems so simple, but we don't learn that.
Yes. If you ever look at a little kid breathing, they do breathe through their bellies. And then as they get older, they start to breathe through their chest. And in the theory, the evolutionary theory behind it is that they start having more stress and they start breathing through their chest just because we have the fight or flight complex and we're trying to actually deal with stress more in our lives. So that's why we want people to learn how to do belly breathing when they want to relax.
Well, I know you're an expert in sleep, but do you ever deal with helping people learn how to breathe properly to reduce anxiety? Because it would seem like those are so tied together.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I work a lot with sleep patients, but my background is in cognitive behavior therapy for anxiety and depression. So I've worked a lot with panic attack patients, generalized anxiety patients. And yeah, we work in all types of anxiety. Doing deep breathing is crucial with those patients. So yeah, we use it all the time.
Yeah. Is there a certain type of deep breathing? Because what I hear is that, you know, for depression, you breathe in more oxygen. For anxiety, you need to slow your out breath. Are there some tools like that that will help people? Simple
Not
tools?
Not so much, at least in the protocols and the types of treatments that I do, it's more of just diaphragmatic breathing, like I was just talking about. And then I add on more, for me, it's more about just making sure you're slowing the pace of the breathing and you're breathing through your belly more so than anything. Less so in depression. I don't use it as much myself in depression just because I deal with a lot more patients, I mean, who are depressed, but also anxious as well. So I tend to add on more of mindfulness components onto the deep breathing techniques. So I will have patients focus on just the technique of being able to breathe out of their belly, slow the pace of the breathing, but then count as well. And if their mind starts to get off of the counting, so like one, relax, two, relax. If they start to get off track, then they can't go to the next number until they can focus on the number completely to say relax. So I focus more on a mindfulness component than other types of techniques on top of the basic diaphragmatic breathing, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And is that the same for depression and anxiety, or do you do something?
Yeah. I think I don't do it as much with depressed patients, but like I said, most of my patients who have insomnia that I work with tend to have depression and anxiety. A lot of times depression and anxiety can go hand in hand anyways.
Right.
So I tend to see a lot more of the anxious patients that do have some depression, but then also have the insomnia. So I'll do, like I said, the mindfulness with just the deep breathing, but not any other modifications to the style. Yeah.
Yeah. And so what are some of the, you mentioned a number of actions that we can take, like avoiding caffeine and not exercising within 3 hours of bedtime and using the bed only for sleep or sex and avoiding like alcohol before 3 hours before bed. What are some of the other techniques you've often talked about, like light and the time that you go to bed? Can you share some more?
Oh, for sure. You know, I think what gets people off track the most when they start having sleep problems is consistency. And I always think about insomnia as becoming an issue with common sense as it starts to really grab hold. So what tends to happen is your common sense is saying to you, like I mentioned earlier, you know, go to bed earlier, sleep in the morning, take a nap because you're tired and you're sleeping. You want to catch the sleep where you can. But what starts to happen is you lose the consistency that you had before. So if you can try and be consistent by keeping the same bed time and the same wake time every day. And like I mentioned earlier, there are parts of that cognitive behavior and therapy for insomnia where we actually spend less time in bed to help sleep more. Mm-hmm. You might spend a few hours less in bed. I would never limit anyone to less than 5 or so hours in bed, but you'd still want to keep that consistent for a week or two. You don't want to go to bed at different times, wake up at different times, because your body clock will never get set. So consistency is very important. Also, if you find that you're having trouble with sleep at night, try to avoid naps during the day as best as you can. The typical patients with insomnia are not excessively sleepy during the day. They're tired, meaning that they have no energy, but they're not very sleepy. They're not dozing left and right, needing to nap. If you're someone who notices that you aren't sleeping well at night, but you're also dozing a lot during the day, and you're really struggling to stay awake or drive, then you might want to see a sleep doctor for an evaluation for other things that might be going on, because it could suggest that maybe sleep apnea is happening. You might be snoring in your sleep. There might be other things that are getting in the way, because you shouldn't be that sleepy. So we actually do ask patients to not even try to nap, although most of my insomnia patients will tell me that they can't even nap even if they try.
Oh, wow. Huh.
Yeah. I mean, napping is really, it's a double-edged sword. If you are able to nap, you might feel good in that moment, but all it does is then steal the sleep from the nighttime. So it's really a challenge.
So would you say, like, when you're traveling, let's say people are going into completely different time zones, it's better, you know, not to take a nap, not to try and go to bed on your...
No, when you're traveling and you have jet lag, then I also will tell my patients to loosen up a little bit on the typical, you know, insomnia treatment rules that we've been dealing with. Because even for someone who doesn't have insomnia, it can take upwards of 2 weeks to get over the jet lag. The rule of thumb has always been number of time zones crossed is how many days it takes to actually adjust to the jet lag. So if you're going to Europe and it's a 6 hour time difference, for some people it can take up to 6 days, even a good sleeper, to adjust to it. So if you must nap, let's say you're going from New York to Paris, best thing to do is to try and actually take an overnight flight. Sleep if you can on the flight. And then when you get in the morning, if you must take a short nap, okay, but really try to stay up as much as you can during the day so that you'll make it easier for you to sleep that night.
Yeah, get into that time zone, the new time zone, as quickly as
possible. Also, there are also, when it comes to jet lag, there are apps that you can download. There's websites that will help, because everyone is going to different places, starting in different locations. Light exposure is really important. Sometimes taking melatonin can actually be really helpful. So there are specific apps that you can download if you look online that can help and give you a very detailed plan of when to get light exposure, when to sleep, and if melatonin is indicated, when to take melatonin, that can help you adjust.
Great. Now, this is something I know you know very well. What about not being able to sleep well when you have like new baby for parents? Like, do you just sort of accept the first 6 months of your child's life as being sleepless for you? Or is there something that parents can do to make their...
Yeah, 6 months is a little long, but you know, it can be that long. Yeah, I always say the first 2 to 3 months, you really are at the beck and call of your child. You know, especially the first 6 weeks to 2 months, The baby is literally born without any set circadian rhythm, because you think about it, a baby is in the womb with no real light and dark exposure. They've been basically in the dark for 9 months. So they have to actually get a circadian rhythm set. So for all those 6 to 8 weeks at the beginning, the baby is trying to set their rhythm to light and dark and get their brain set so that they can sleep better at night. So you're basically at their call initially, and to just sort of try to sleep whenever you can, do whatever you can, accept help, and try and work. If you have a partner who's very helpful, who's willing and able to get up in the middle of the night and hand off feedings, or if mom needs to breastfeed, but maybe the partner can then change the baby and do other things in the middle of the night, you take different shifts, that can be really helpful. And then starting at about 2 months, I recommend that people really start, even though the baby might not have a set bedtime at that point, start to just create an artificial bedtime. So even if it's 8 o'clock at night, now you start a bath routinely, or maybe a bath every other night. And then you read a book and you get them changed, and then you put them in bed, and you just have a routine that's set. And over time, there are all different ways for people to do sleep training if they want to. If they don't, it's whatever works for you, whatever you choose. You have to address it somehow. And it will get better, but you have to, you know, you have to just kind of ride the wave for a bit.
Yeah, I think meditation probably helps in that process too.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Like a lot of people will start saying, you know, I can't do this anymore. This is never, yeah, I remember with my first kid, I never thought this would end.
Yeah.
And with the second one, I was able to be in the moment, enjoy it more, and just kind of, you know, sit there and appreciate in an odd way those 3 a.m. feedings more, because I knew that it wouldn't last forever, and to really just be in that moment. And if you can practice that, it makes a huge difference.
Yeah, that's such good advice. The last topic I want to just cover here is about technology, which is huge, right? Because you've already said that we should only use the bed for sleep and sex. And, you know, so many people bring their laptops or their phones, whatever, to bed. They're looking at Facebook. They're looking at the news of the day. What's your opinion on what we need to do with technology in order to sort of calm and get ready for bed?
I think technology is fantastic to help people relax, but it's, you have to be careful with it. So it's more of the blue light exposure that's the problem. So when we're always, at least in the sleep field, when we say avoid screens, don't stare at screens right before bed, the reason that we're saying that is because of the blue light that's emitted from those devices. That being said, a lot of them nowadays, I know on the iPhone, the newest updates, you can actually get night shift, which is just, you just put that on and it gets rid of a lot of the blue light, and it gives it a more reddish kind of warming hue to it. So, and on laptops, there are different apps or programs that you can download that will put on that warming tone. You can also just get blue blocking glasses, like get them online very easily. So if you're someone that really wants to stare at the computer screen, try to block the blue light as best you can. Then it's a question of what are you actually looking at? So are you doing a relaxation exercise, or do you then tend to like go onto Facebook and Twitter and do other things? Because that can also make you more stressed if you're looking at social media at night or the news or whatever it is. But if you want to use a relaxation app, I think they're fantastic. Just turn it on. If you can, put on one of those blue light blockers like I was talking about, and then just turn it over. Because remember, it's about being, listening to the instructions, being in the moment, not necessarily staring at the screen. So listen to whatever the instructions are, if it's a visualization exercise, a breathing exercise, and you don't have to stare at the screen until it's over, and then you turn it off and you get in bed. And the ideal is to really do all those things outside of the bed. Find a nice comfortable chair, do things to relax before going to bed so that you can set the stage for sleep. And then when you're actually sleepy, get in bed, because we want the bed ideally to be prepared for sleep. You don't want to always have to rely on having a phone next to you to always be able to go to sleep. That's the ideal. I mean, I have a lot of patients who do deep breathing and other exercises when they get into bed. But my fear is one day they might not have the phone, or it's out of battery, or something happens. What are they going to do? Are they going to be able to go to sleep on their own? So the ideal is to not need those things and to do them outside of the bed. But I think apps for relaxation are awesome when it comes to winding down the brain and the body, as long as you're not staring at the blue light.
Right. Okay. So is there any other advice that we haven't covered that you would recommend for people with trouble sleeping?
I think those are the big ones. It also just to recognize also the thoughts that you're having. If you tend to have a lot of, I always say the rational brain is not there at 2 or 3 in the morning. So what are the thoughts that you're having about the next day and the effects of what poor sleep is going to do to you? So try to be aware that you're having those sticky thoughts. Try to get back, practice mindfulness in the middle of the night. If you can get back to your breathing, back to the relaxation, out of bed, if you're not sleeping, but also if you need to challenge some of the thoughts during the day. Is it realistic that I'm not going to be able to function at all? Will I fail my job? Will I have problems at work, problems in my marriage? Is that necessarily going to happen? Has that happened in the past? Sometimes challenging those thoughts can be very helpful as well. And I think the one other thing is, like, as I look outside my window, it's summer out. It's really bright outside. And people are asking me more and more, what do they do at night? And how do they go to bed early if it's so bright out? And I usually tell them to get light blocking shades. Keep your room as dark as possible. It's really important. And that will help you sleep as well.
Wow. Well, I think you've made a lot of people happy with this advice. Thank you so much, Shelby.
And it was my pleasure.
Yeah, just great to hear from you again. Thanks a million.
Thanks, Patricia.
Thanks so much to Shelby for her great sleep tips and to our sponsor, Sattva Mattresses. You can find out more about them at sattvamattress.com. If you enjoyed our podcast today, can you take a minute to rate and review it? And if you have feedback or suggestions for guests, email us at patricia@meditationstudioapp.com. And don't forget to download Meditation Studio in the App Store or on Google Play. We'll see you next week.